loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Trump administration and Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions III's Justice Department have been closing halfway houses, canceling contracts with 16 since taking office and worsening the mass incarceration crisis in the United States. Next, as part of his Vision 2030 plan to overhaul the Saudi economy, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has announced that the planned $500 billion, 10,000-square-mile NEOM megacity will be a publicly traded commodity owned by its shareholders. In his words, the first capitalist city in the world. Then, U.S.-Pakistan relations continued to deteriorate today as the Pakistani foreign minister fired back at criticism of his country's support for terrorists by slamming the United States' failure in the war in Afghanistan. And finally, the U.S. Congress, through the Government Accountability Office, is moving to counter the Trump administration's so-called voter fraud commission. But are the Democratic senators who requested the move and who say they oppose the panel because it diminishes confidence in our democratic process missing the point? That's all starting now on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the Trump administration and the so-called Justice Department. The Trump administration and Jeff Sessions, Attorney General, have been cutting down on halfway houses, canceling contracts with 16 since taking office, and worsening the mass incarceration crisis in the United States. We are joined from Nashville, Tennessee, by Alex Friedman. He is the Associate Director of the Human Rights Defense Center and Managing Editor for Prison Legal News. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me on again.
Why are they cutting halfway houses?
Well, that's a good question, actually. One would think that if they really were interested in reducing recidivism and helping prisoners readjust to society after being released, that they would be expanding and not curtailing halfway houses. But most likely they claim it's fiscally related, that it has to do with budgetary issues.
Alex, explain to us how that makes any sense. Isn't it true that most, if not all, halfway houses are for-profit entities that actually are not drains on the federal budget?
Well, a number of halfway houses, most are probably nonprofit, actually. Some are for-profit, some are nonprofit. In both cases, the federal government contracts with them to provide these services. And typically that does involve, you know, payment by the federal government as part of the contracts. So, I mean, like anything in life, nothing's free. You know, halfway house services do cost the government something. But you have to think of it this way. You have short-term versus long-term costs. If people successfully complete halfway house stays and get out and stay out of prison, that is much less expensive than in the long term if they go back to prison and have to be reincarcerated.
John Kiriakou, you, as our audience knows, had the misfortune of being prosecuted by the Obama administration and then sent to federal prison because of your role in exposing the George W. Bush torture program that George W. Bush and others said did not exist. They went after you like a ton of bricks.
Mm-hmm.
When you got out, well, just help the audience understand, what is a halfway house? What does it do? How does it transition a prisoner from being inside of a prison, either a federal or a state prison, to the outside society?
Right. Even though I transitioned directly from prison to house arrest, or what they call home confinement, I was still technically assigned to a halfway house in Washington, D.C. So I had to go there, physically go there every single day for 87 days. And what they do is, you know, they give you a drug test, they give you a breathalyzer to make sure you're not drinking. That's all fine and good. But what they also do is they give you a series of classes, mandatory classes. I was actually exempt because I didn't need them, and I proved that I didn't need them. But 99% of released prisoners do need them. Things like how to write a resume, or how to do a job interview, or how to balance a checkbook. They have suicide prevention classes, or classes on depression and anxiety. You know, things that a lot of newly released prisoners are going to have to deal with. And you don't get any of that in prison. you know, there's no or almost no education that you can take in prison unless you need to get a GED. They will give you that. But otherwise, nothing. There's no job training. And so when you get to a halfway house, at least you've got some time where you can get on your feet, you can learn a skill, and then reenter the workforce. If the Justice Department ends that, you're going to have people going directly from prison straight back to the streets. Now, what this does is it effectively lengthens prison sentences because I'm going to use the federal government as an example because that's my area of experience. Every federal prisoner is allowed up to something like 12 months of halfway house. Nobody really gets 12 months, but you're allowed up to 12 months. Most people get 3 to 6 months of halfway house. So you leave prison early, go to the halfway house. You're not going to spend all that whole time, the 3 to 12 months in the halfway house. You're going to spend a couple of weeks, maybe up to a couple of months. You're going to get passes to go home and reintegrate with your family and with society. And then they're going to send you home permanently. And the rest of your halfway house time converts into house arrest or home confinement. You're allowed to leave the house to go to work, to go to church, to go to the doctor, or to go on family outings on Saturdays and Sundays. So you really are reintegrated into society and reacquainted with your family, which is exactly the point. But if they end halfway houses or reduce halfway house time for whatever reason, whether it's to save money or because they don't like ex-felons or whatever the reason is, you're going to stay in prison longer. You're not going to get that job training. You're not going to get those classes to help you reintegrate. You're not going to reestablish your relationship with your family. And when you finally go back home, you're going to do the only thing you know how to do, and that's to lead a life of crime. And so over the long term, as Alex has said, this is going to increase recidivism rates, and it's going to cost the government more and more money. It's not going to save them anything.
Alex, recidivism, for the people who may not be familiar with the word, means people who leave prison and end up going back to prison. How big of a problem is that?
Oh, it's an enormous problem. There's a couple of different definitions of recidivism, depending on whether people are rearrested, reconvicted, or re-imprisoned. But the most broad definition, we have a recidivism rate of around 70% in the United States over a five-year period after release, which is just abysmal and is a testament to how inadequate and dysfunctional our system is. Obviously, I think people would agree that one of the purposes of our prison system is to ensure that people receive the treatment programs and resources that they need to get out of prison and not come back. And we don't want people just going through a revolving door of committing more crimes. You know, we actually want to stop the entire criminal process. But that really is not the way the system is set up. The system is generally set up really to ensure that people fail and come back to prison, and that's evidenced by such a high recidivism rate. Halfway houses are an important part of the justice system in that they provide a bridge between people who have served a long time in prison, typically, and those getting out and going back to their communities. Unfortunately, we've never really put the resources into halfway houses that they deserve and need, and many halfway houses have very bad reputations as being little more than just kind of places to warehouse people and take half their paychecks while they're working, and not provide them really with any kind of good skills or services or treatment programs that they could use to help them when they get out. That being said, there are some good halfway houses out there with good programs. The notion, though, that the Bureau of Prisons is cutting back on halfway houses really is counterintuitive. Again, you know, we should be providing more services for people upon reentry to the community, not less.
Alex, let me ask you a question about that, too. The Justice Department announced last Friday afternoon, actually, once the daily news cycle was closed, that they were shutting down 16 halfway houses. There have to be several hundred halfway houses around the country. So is this the first in several or more than several closures, or is this a one-shot deal that we're looking at?
Well, we don't really know at this point. I checked the Bureau of Prisons website, indicates that right now, they have about 171 halfway house contracts nationwide. These facilities are more formally known as residential reentry centers, or RRCs. and they're, again, an important component in our justice system. Whether or not the BOP is going to continue to contract and withdraw from these halfway house contracts is an unknown. We're not sure. I think that criminal justice advocates are concerned right now, regardless of whether there's going to be additional closures, just based upon the notion that the Bureau of Prisons would close 16 of these facilities or withdraw from 16 of these contracts.
You know, Brian, in the Justice Department's announcement last Friday, they said that they were closing halfway houses that were deemed to be geographically unnecessary. But then when you look at some of the halfway houses that were closed, they included, for example, the only halfway house in Dayton, Ohio, which is a large city, and the only halfway house in Columbia, Missouri. I had a cellmate in prison. I was at the Federal Correctional Institution at Loretto, Pennsylvania. And he was from a rural area in northwestern Pennsylvania near the New York border. And so he told me that he had been reincarcerated twice for absconding from the halfway house. I asked him, well, why would you abscond from the halfway house? Why would you just leave? And he said, because they kept putting me in a halfway house in Pittsburgh. And he said, I don't know anybody in Pittsburgh. I'm not related to anybody in Pittsburgh. My family's 120 miles away from Pittsburgh, and I wanted to see my family, and they wouldn't let me, he said. And so he would get on a bus and go up to northern Pennsylvania and visit his family. He would get arrested, and they would send him back to prison. Now we're going to have a situation where we have even fewer halfway houses. And, you know, you have to wonder about people like, let's use as an example, Jeffrey Sterling, another CIA officer who was convicted of national security crimes, despite the fact that there was literally no evidence that he had committed those crimes. But Jeffrey is due to be released sometime in January, and that may be canceled now because the halfway house that he was supposed to go to in St. Louis, Missouri, is now one of these ones that's being considered for closure. Another problem with Jeffrey's situation is that he actually doesn't live in St. Louis, Missouri. He lives in a town 45 miles west of St. Louis. So even if he does get released and he does go to this halfway house, how in the world is he supposed to go back and forth between the halfway house and his home, or vice versa, if his time is converted into home confinement, when prisoners who are newly released and resident at a halfway house or detailed to a halfway house are not even permitted to drive? So this only makes the situation worse for prisoners all over the country.
And Alex Friedman, there's another part of this too. While the halfway houses may be geographically not where they need to be for the prisons are not where they need to be for prisoners. I grew up close to Attica in Rochester, New York. Way rural western New York, and the prisoners were predominantly from New York City and other places, and it took forever for their families to come here. In the United States, there are more prisoners today than there are farmers, and it seems to me like the government has decided that to replace farming for rural economies, it's to build prisons, but the prisoners are coming from urban areas largely, and so they can't really survive well there, and their families can't come and visit them. I mean, it's a completely irrational system. Go ahead, Alex. We have about 90 seconds left. You're going to get the final word here.
Well, I would agree with that statement and say that unfortunately, you know, our justice system is not really designed to accomplish the goals that a lot of people would like it to accomplish. You know, our criminal justice system focuses more on the criminal, less on the justice. In this particular case, though, it really is a no-brainer. The Bureau of Prisons is really being penny-wise and pound-foolish when it comes to shutting down facilities that would help prisoners get out and stay out of prison. I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, we have 2.3 million people in prison, John. One out of every four prisoners in the world is here in the United States. If anything, by shutting down halfway houses, as you said, and as Alex Friedman from the Prison Legal News said, this just extends people's stay in prison. It increases the number of people who are incarcerated, the great scandal in America. Anyway, we're going to come back and see whether this is the beginning of a new trend. Alex Friedman, I want to thank you for joining us. You can read Alex's writings and the writings of other of his associates at Prison Legal News. He's the associate director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the managing editor for Prison Legal News. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
As part of his Vision 2030 plan to overhaul the Saudi economy, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has announced that the planned $500 billion, 10,000 square mile NEOM megacity will be a publicly traded commodity owned by its shareholders. In his words, the first capitalist city in the world. We're joined by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Ali, does the world know anything like this proposed city? Is there anything in existence that even rivals this idea?
I think there are cities very close to this. In China, where we saw the establishment of cities in the Shanghai region and different regions of China, I think this is the greatest, one of the greatest heists in history, because we are going to see a repeat of 2006 when the Saudi stock market lost, a few hundred billion dollars that went to the Saudi ruling family out of the pockets of the citizenry. And I think this is another attempt in doing that, because the main question is, what is this city going to produce? And that question has not been answered yet.
Interestingly enough, in the Bloomberg reporting, and it's repeated also on CNBC, there's talk even of the world's of building the world's longest bridge to connect this city with Egypt and then open up Africa by road. What would that serve? How would that help Saudi Arabia or help this new megacity to be open to Africa?
I don't think these are realistic issues, because I don't think the amount of trade between Africa and Europe, requires a land bridge, and the ships that crosses the Red Sea are not, they don't have enough business, because there is not really that great of commercial ties between the Gulf and Africa. So there was a talk of a bridge over the Bab el-Mandeb. But, if you look at the numbers, the most of the business or the trade between the Gulf is with Europe and the United States, and, of course, with China. So what are they going to do with Africa? I have no idea. They're spending $500 billion to build a bridge and to build a city it's a mirage to me, because that's not the first time the Saudi ruling family has come up with this. What sounds to be great ideas, but at the end they come to nothing. We have many examples, such as the Saudi much celebrated economic cities, which will bring in millions of jobs and have their own laws and so on. They never materialize. The same thing with the Saudi great gas initiative that's going to create 1 million jobs for Saudis. It never came about. So you are seeing many things and many examples of previous Saudi announcements that are mostly public relations stunts to create diversions from the problems that they are suffering inside the country with their population.
Ali, let's talk about the new emerging leadership. I mean, it's already emerged, but it hasn't been fully consummated in Saudi Arabia. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Why is he making this announcement? He's also appears to be, at least in the Western media, the champion for some sort of reforms, women being able to drive. Are these significant? And also, what's likely to happen with this government, not only in terms of its economic and social policies, but also its foreign policy as it relates to, say, the war in Yemen, or as it relates to its relations with other Gulf countries, including, of course, Qatar, and regionally? How do you see it playing out? That, of course, the West says this is a new, young leader, vibrant, reformist, et cetera. What's your take?
The West has been repeating the same broken record with every Saudi leadership. Because, if you go back to 1955, when King Saud arrived to Washington, the Time magazine had their former king title. The same thing happened with Faisal, Khalid, Fahad, Abdullah, and now with Salman. So this is really just PR. If we see this in 1962, I believe, the Holland Knowlton, which was hired by the Saudis then, this is the exact wording, that Saudi Arabia is embarking on massive transformation. That was 1963. Where is that transformation? We don't see it. So you are really seeing just a broken record and a West that is willing to support this dictatorship that's not even calling on to share power with the population or part of the power. So I don't see much difference. In fact, with this young entitled leadership, you will see much more aggressive policy inward and outward, vis-a-vis especially the war in Yemen, which Saudi Crown Prince said that it will continue, and with increasing oppression against the population in terms of censoring. In fact, now it's official the Saudis have a minister or a ministry sort of manage or to really just focus on the internet and social networks to crush any dissent. And we see that this new leader is much more harsh in terms of dealing with dissent, and we've seen that in the large numbers of arrests and also in the executions that happened early on in 2016. So I don't see anything in such so-called reforms. Those who say this is a reform, they are being paid, honestly, to say that. And the few only are totally ignorant. But most of them, from the experience that I had, is they are paid to say such things. So no matter who they are, British or American or whatever, they are paid to say this is reform. This is not reform. Reform is when you share power, when you devolve power to the population. That's not happened yet. And I don't see it willingly happening with this regime.
Ali, let's talk about Mohammed bin Salman and this notion of liberalization. He announced recently that women would be allowed to begin driving in Saudi Arabia in 2018. And also with the announcement of this megacity, he said that it would be separate and apart from normal Saudi laws in that, and he said this specifically, women would be able to jog while wearing long jogging tights, that women would not have to cover their faces, which of course they have to do elsewhere around the country. He also made a statement that he wanted to return Saudi Arabia to a more inclusive kind of Islam, with the implication being that it had once been a moderate country. I would take exception with that. But do you think that any of these liberalized ideas can really become the norm in Saudi Arabia, even if it's just in this one new megacity?
Talking about going back and having a country that's tolerant, you know, what we will do very easily, get rid of the Saudi state. Before the Saudi state came about, people were very, tolerant comparatively to even other countries in the Middle East. It is the Saudi system, the Saudi government and its ideology that has imposed and spread dictatorship and extremism through its religious message that has affected the population and hijacked their religion through education, through the control of the media and so on, and the total control of the religious narrative. In fact, the Sunni schools of Islam in the Arabian Peninsula have been destroyed by the Saudi government. Today, you don't see Maliki, Shafi'i, or Hanafi schools of Islam in the Arabian Peninsula, which they were the dominant force, and they were very tolerant comparatively to the Wahhabi, Salafi Islam. So if you need to go back to the moderate, then you have to get rid of the Saudi state. In terms of having just an enclave for freedoms, you know, where women do not have to wear or to apply Saudi law, this has been said before regarding King Abdullah Economic City, and it did not happen, did not come to reality. Secondly, this is apartheid. The This is exactly what happened under the apartheid rule in South Africa, where the blacks lived in squalor and the whites lived in relative freedoms and representative democracy. This is exactly what's happening here. I don't think this will happen. Really, to me, this is very much a PR campaign and an attempt on basically siphoning more money from the pockets of the population. That's why they put it out as a public traded company, and they will promote it inside the country so people will invest in it, and then they will lose their shirts. This is exactly what I foresee happening in that place.
You know, Brian, I was stationed in Bahrain from 1994 to 1996. Bahrain is a very small country in the Arabian Gulf, just off the east coast of Saudi Arabia. And the emir of Bahrain at the time, Sheikh Isa bin Salman Al Khalifa, was very strongly pro-American. And he would invite American diplomats to his beach house every weekend if you wanted to go swimming. And my wife and I would always go with our young son. And His Highness was there, and he would frequently invite us for tea. And we would frequently talk about Saudi Arabia, really saying exactly the same thing that Ali just told our listeners. And the emir said something to me about Saudi Arabia and about Bahrain that has stuck with me all these years. He said, "Sometimes I don't feel like the king of a country. Sometimes I feel like the mayor of an amusement park at the end of a long bridge." And it was because when the Saudis wanted to go to nightclubs and go drinking and see the dancing girls and take their shirts off to go to the beach and have their wives walk around in shorts, they would get in the car and drive across the causeway. It's a 12-mile bridge to Bahrain, and they would enjoy a weekend before then going back to their own country. Well, if you were a Sunni Muslim in Saudi Arabia, you could do that. The Shia couldn't do that because they're discriminated against both in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain. But it seems to me that Mohammed bin Salman, being of this younger generation, wants to try to put that amusement park at the end of a long bridge in his own country. And it's going to cost $500 billion. And the likelihood is that it's just simply not going to happen. Ali, what do you think?
I think really what we have seen historically, and I think previous history and precedent tells us a lot, that we have seen these pronouncements before of these great economic project that will make everything well. The problem is when you talk about an imaginary city and a mirage that we can come up with, while at the same time ignoring the actual problems that's happening in the country. For example, in Saudi Arabia, the capital city of Riyadh does not have public transportation or bus service. And they don't even have a sewage system. So every house, most 80% of the houses in Riyadh are basically relegated to have a septic tank. And they have to call the company every month or so to suck that trash and then dump it in the desert in what they call these massive lakes of human waste. If they can do that, I mean, why are they spending $500 billion to build that? They should have a priority in terms of building schools that are decent. Right now, schools in Saudi Arabia are mostly rented and substandard. They don't even have central air conditioning. Can you believe it? In the hottest country in the world, one of the hottest countries in the world, all schools in Saudi Arabia do not have central air conditioning. It's all these window units. And they couldn't do that. They couldn't have bus service in the capital. They couldn't solve the 70% home non-ownership. 70% of the population plus of the population do not own their homes in this large country that's supposed to be very cheap to own the land. That's because of the corruption of the system, because of the monarchy taking land and letting very little on the market. The price of land is inflated because of the massive corruption and land seizure. So if they couldn't solve this problem, I don't know why are they selling this dream, pipe dream, really, to the population. That's not going to solve the problem of 20 million people who have sufficient schools or public transportation or healthcare system and so on. So I think this is really a pipe dream. It's not going to solve the 40% unemployment among men and 80% unemployment among women. So, and that's not going to do that. So I think it is really just, it's focused for the outside. It's an opportunity. It has been an opportunity for international scammers who come and say, oh, we will invest, and then they take the money and run. And that's going to happen at the end of the day. Because, again, no one can say what is that city going to make and create and can sell. It's nothing. Maybe some beaches, and I think the world does not have scarcity of beaches that they need to go to Saudi Arabia to enjoy the sun.
Very interesting. We've been joined from Ali Al-Ahmad. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. We've been speaking to him right here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
U.S.-Pakistan relations continued to deteriorate today as the Pakistani foreign minister fired back at criticism of his country's support for terrorists by slamming the United States' failure in the war in Afghanistan. We are joined from Toronto by Christopher Black. He is an international criminal defense lawyer at the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Welcome back, Chris.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Chris, I was very interested in the statement from the Pakistani foreign minister that Pakistan insists on protection of its sovereignty, on treatment as an equal partner. How is that any different at all from what the Pakistanis have been demanding of the U.S. government since the war in Afghanistan by the Soviets?
Exactly. And you have to wonder what exactly the United States is trying to achieve by continual criticism of Pakistan, and at the same time, as the Pakistanis say, trying to use them as proxies to fight their battle. I would suggest that the American attack on an invasion of Afghanistan was for all sorts of strategic purposes, and Pakistan is right next to Afghanistan as part of the general scheme of things that they want to control one way or the other. So undermining Pakistan in various ways, and this criticism is part of that. And using the Taliban and so on against them, which is what the Pakistanis say is part of the American government's plan to control Asia.
Let me ask you about the legality of some of this, too. You're an international criminal attorney. Give us some insights. One of the things that that the George W. Bush administration did and the Barack Obama administration did was to conduct military or paramilitary operations on Pakistani soil, all in the name of counterterrorism. We know that that's illegal. Now, the Trump administration is demanding that the Pakistanis step up military activities against the Taliban and against the Pakistani Taliban, which is resident in the north of Pakistan. Presumably, if the Pakistani government doesn't do that to the satisfaction of the Trump White House, the Trump White House will do exactly what Bush and Obama did and launch military or paramilitary operations deeper into Pakistani territory. Is that in any way legal? And even if it isn't, is it sustainable?
No, I mean, it's certainly not sustainable. The American, I think, General Nicholson stated just last year that the Afghan army sustained 25,000 casualties in 2015, and I'm sure they're worse now. And they said that would normally break the back of normal armies, but we sustain them. I mean, those are huge casualty numbers. So the American invasion of and trying and occupation of Afghanistan has been a complete failure, as the Pakistanis point out rightly. But they don't want to leave because the benefits for them are too high. So they insist on staying. The invasion was illegal. It was obviously planned long before 9/11 because they invaded just 1 month after 9/11. And it took a long time to plan that. The hunt for Osama bin Laden was just an excuse. And the hunt for Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, when they allegedly or they claimed to have killed him and buried him at sea, was again to make Pakistan look bad, and to in the eyes of the American people that Pakistan's helping terrorism, and that's the continual complaint of the Americans that Pakistan's helping through the Haqqani network of undermining their presence in Afghanistan, as if they own Afghanistan, have the right to be there.
John Kiriakou, you were in that region. You were with the CIA at the time. The invasion of Afghanistan started October 7th, 2001, a little bit less than a month after September 11th. Given the fact that Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan and al-Qaeda had been given sort of guest status in Afghanistan by the Taliban. It didn't surprise me that much that the United States decided to invade Afghanistan.
Sure.
But what did what became clear was that Afghanistan, in fact, didn't appear to be the priority. Kind of like we had to hit Afghanistan because that's where Osama was. But this provided the ultimate pretext for the war on terror, so-called, which meant a blank check to invade anywhere like Iraq. I mean, why was Osama bin Laden still even alive after the U.S. invasion? Because the government of the Taliban and al-Qaeda was scattered so quickly.
Well, it was, to tell you the truth, it was utter incompetence on the part of U.S. military leaders. You know, there's this famous story about the commander of CENTCOM at the time, who was that? General Franks, I suppose.
Tommy Franks.
Tommy Franks, having surrounded Tora Bora, the mountain at Tora Bora on which Osama bin Laden was believed to have been hiding. And a middleman who was communicating both with CENTCOM commanders and with al-Qaeda commanders asked CENTCOM to not launch an attack until morning so that women and children could be evacuated. Well, of course, they evacuated everybody. And then when CENTCOM moved up the mountain in the morning, everybody was gone. So, you know, it's easy to think of conspiracies that we let Osama bin Laden go, we looked the other way. It's just that we were brazenly incompetent. I think that's number one. Number two, this is a fundamental misunderstanding on the part of the United States of Muslim culture. We just don't understand as a nation the necessity of saving face. And so we go into Afghanistan purportedly to break al-Qaeda. Well, we broke al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, for all intents and purposes, was finished by the end of the year. Sure, we hadn't yet captured bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri or a handful of others, but for all intents and purposes, al-Qaeda essentially ceased to exist as a viable organization by the end of 2001. But then we decided, well, while we're here, we're going to start cleaning up other things that have caused us problems. We had no particular beef with the Taliban, but we decided in late 2001 that we were going to attack the Taliban next, and we did that. And then once we broke the Taliban, or pushed them into Pakistan at least, then we decided we're going to attack the Haqqani network. Now, the Haqqanis are not nice people. They're rough people. They are, or can be, I think, legitimately accused of being terrorists. But at the same time, we were dealing with the Haqqani network. We had a relationship with the Haqqani network. We just decided to expand the mission as it suited us. Now, why would we do that? For a whole bunch of reasons that we've spoken about extensively on this program. Because our economy is it's a permanent wartime economy. Because a lot of people get rich on increased defense spending. It's good for politicians to say that they're strong on national security. And it's fund for the U.S. military. That's why we did it. It wasn't for counterterrorism. It's because we could spend all this money on defense, put Americans to work, and have all these great toys to play with.
Christopher Black, when the invasion happened, As John Kiriakou pointed out, a big part of the Taliban and whatever remained of al-Qaeda was pushed back into Pakistan. The U.S. sought to have a relationship with Pakistan, did have a relationship. It went in, it captured people, it kidnapped people, it tortured people, killed people. Why is the Trump administration now setting its sights on Pakistan and demanding that Pakistan sort of shut down sanctuary for Taliban? Why the focus on Pakistan right now by Trump, do you think?
So I think it's the easiest lever to try and move in face of the Russian initiative to create a peace and have the Americans pushed out of Afghanistan. The Russians held a meeting in February, and I think in Moscow, with China, Pakistan, and another one after that, in which they invited Afghanistan and India to take part in peace talks, and they're suggesting in the next meeting that the Taliban be invited so that they're recognizing the Taliban as an official party. The American government doesn't like that, and all indications are that the dropping the mother of big bombs and the troop increase and this and that are all attempts to sabotage that effort, because the American government wants to stay, as they said, they intend to stay there forever. They intend to control Eurasia, and it's quite clear that's their aim. So yes, it's illegal, but I think now they see and have seen Pakistan as one of the weaker links, because it's more or less aligned with China usually, but India is there and in action. And the Indians, we don't know what they're going to do, but it looks to me like the American government is going to try and pressure Pakistan to cooperate their way, or they're going to do something and invade their sovereignty in various ways.
I think that's right. I think Christopher's right. And let me tell you, Brian, from firsthand experience, that the Pakistanis that I worked with were some of the bravest people I've ever encountered. They did everything we asked them to do. They hated Al-Qaeda as much as we did, and they did everything we asked them. Not just that, they were always the first ones through the door and the only ones not wearing protective body armor. That's how tough these guys were. Now, we disagree with the Pakistanis on issues like Kashmir, for example, or funding for Kashmiri separatists, but that's a political issue. When it comes to Al-Qaeda, or when it comes to Pakistani Taliban, who have launched attacks against the Pakistani central government, we're on the same sheet of music. To me, this threat from the Trump White House is really just a matter of disrespect. And it's also indicative that neither the president nor his intelligence and foreign policy advisors on the National Security Council really know what in the world they're doing. If they knew what they were doing, they wouldn't have allowed him to make a statement like this.
Well, I'd like to ask both of you what public opinion's like in Pakistan. Pakistan's not a small country. It's an important and a large country. Here you have the United States bombing Pakistan, lots of drone strikes. And also even the capture of Osama bin Laden, it was done through the kind of subterfuge that would make everyone ultimately and always suspicious of the United States, because in the name of trying to carry out, I think it was vaccines or yes, public health policy interviews with the population, they were able to gather intelligence. In other words, that's so crazy too, because it would mean nobody in the future would ever want to cooperate even for a public health initiative.
And that's why there's a polio outbreak in northern Pakistan.
Right. Yeah, and have to remember a few years back, there was a large number of bombings of mosques in Pakistan, killed thousands of people, bombings every week. And it was claimed terrorists were doing that, and of different sorts, the Haqqani Network, Taliban, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a big story went through Pakistan at that time, which all the people there remember, of a CIA agent being arrested by a police after firefight with the police for some reason. And they had it checked his car, and in it he had dozens of cell phones and maps of different mosques and explosive devices and notes and all sorts of things. And he was arrested, and the American government had him taken out of there and went back to the States. But most people in Pakistan, whatever he was doing, have grave suspicions about what he was doing and who was responsible for those mosque bombings. So there's a deep resentment of American influence in Pakistan, but I think among common people.
Yeah, John, you were there too. What do you think? What do you think about public opinion? We have about a minute left.
There's not a country in the world more unpopular in Pakistan than the United States. Even our friends in the Pakistani military or the intelligence services or Pakistani elected officials tell us very clearly in private conversations that we're not reliable friends. We use them when we need them, and when we don't need them, we walk away from them and we abandon them. And unfortunately, that's true.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Toronto, Canada by Christopher Black. He's an international criminal defense lawyer at the International Criminal Court. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The U.S. Congress, through the Government Accountability Office, is moving to counter the Trump administration's so-called Voter Fraud Commission. But are the Democratic senators who requested the move, who say that they oppose the panel because it, quote, diminishes confidence in our democratic process, close quote, missing the real point? We are joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. The U.S. Congress Watchdog Office has agreed to investigate Trump's Commission on Voter Fraud after the three Democratic senators raised concerns about the panel's work and how it may diminish confidence in the democratic process. What's your take on all that?
Well, my take on all that is that the Democrats have a point, that the Republicans have been playing a game trying to restrict voter access, scare minority voters off, and they're very concerned. And I think that Trump isn't playing into these tactics. He's aiding them, and I think the Democrats are mobilizing in response. But, you know, like everything in Washington, there are layers and layers of politics. So it's always very complex and really hard to figure out and a lot of cross currents.
Daniel, let me ask you about the actual incidence of voter fraud. It seems to me, just going through the press since the election, that only one person has been formally accused of voter fraud, and that was a woman in Iowa who voted for Trump twice because she said she wanted to cancel out a liberal vote. Is there any real voter fraud, like really, that's going on?
I think it's minimal at most. I mean, it's just that, I mean, the problem in the United States is that too few people turn out to vote, not that people are voting multiple times. And this is just kind of like, it just wouldn't make any sense for people to do this kind of stuff.
Now, it seems like there are so many ways to catch people that it wouldn't make sense.
Yes, and it's such a retail effort. I mean, trying to corral people and herd them down to the voting booths and to, somehow arrange them to vote two or three times in elections in which there are thousands and thousands of voters. It'd be like a huge amount of effort for a very small return.
Trump established this panel in May after charging, Daniel, that millions of illegal immigrants, as he put it, voted in the November 2016 election. He also said if it hadn't been for all this voter fraud, he indeed would have not only won the Electoral College, but he would have won the popular vote. On its face, that just seems obviously ridiculous, absurd, bizarre. He has no evidence. And yet, Donald Trump has created a commission on voter fraud.
It's just wild. Yes, of course. It's absurd, ridiculous, outlandish. Trump lost the popular vote. That's why he is in so much trouble, because he essentially his legitimacy is in doubt. He was sort of got in on a constitutional fluke, but he lost the election. So no one knows what to make of that. For the second time in less than 20 years. We've had kind of a false outcome in the U.S. presidential election. So his legitimacy is in dispute. No one can really believe he's president, and he's making up all these silly stories and how bolster his standing.
John Kiriakou, since 1988, the Republicans have only won one popular vote.
Yes.
That was in 2004 against John Kerry, when George W. Bush was hated, which was an unusual outcome. But the Republicans are constantly making the argument about voter fraud. It seems to me that the bigger issue here, Daniel, is actually not only low voter turnout because of apathy or people's disillusionment with the presidential campaign, but there are efforts at voter suppression. Talk about what that amounts to and whether that's a significant thing in America.
Oh, that's a very significant thing in America. Very significant. There are major efforts underway to cull the ranks of voters, especially minority voters who typically vote Democratic. So essentially, Republicans are trying to tamper with the rolls, force people off, pass all kinds of laws requiring the pet to produce photo IDs. Striking off whole classes of voters, such as people who've done prison time, et cetera, with the idea of just reducing minority turnout and thereby undercutting the Democrats. And this is very serious. And, this is and I say this not as a partisan of the Democrats, but as a partisan of small D democracy. They are playing with the elections, and there's nothing more fundamental in a democracy than an election.
I have to agree with you. You know, it seems to me like this is a scandal. Voter suppression and gerrymandering ought to be a scandal because it's anti-democratic and it's un-American. And that's really the conversation that we should be having on the front page of the major newspapers in this country or on the evening news, not Donald Trump's voter fraud panel.
That's not the only scandal. The other scandal is the Electoral College.
That's right.
Which essentially not only produces a fluke, as it did in 2000 and 2016, but also it triples the weight of certain rural, underpopulated, mainly white states. So it hurts minorities in that way. The other scandal, which I am constantly harping on, but I'm just not the only person in this entire country, is the U.S. Senate, which gives 3% of the population that lives in the 10 least populous states the same clout as the 55% who live in the 10 most populous states. There is no legislative body in the putative democratic world which is more unrepresentative than the U.S. Senate. Yes, no one talks about it except for me.
That's true. It has nothing on, or the House of Lords, I should say, has nothing on the U.S. Senate.
Well, let's just tell people, I'm just looking at some of the numbers. The number of people who live in California is 39 million, and they have 2 Senate votes. And the number of people living in Wyoming is 450,000, and they have 2 Senate votes.
And California is a minority-majority state, and Wyoming, last I checked, was like 90% white. Now I can't understand. I really can't understand. I'm totally perplexed by this. Why aren't people hopping up and down, screaming themselves hoarse, protesting this? There is almost complete silence in the American media across the ideological spectrum. The Nation, liberal publications like The Nation, The New Republic, etc., New York Times, I think The Nation and The New Republic never mentioned this. New York Times, actually, curiously enough, has written about this in the past, but it is really the only one.
I'm looking at some other numbers here. The number of people who, John Kiriakou, who cannot vote because of felony convictions, let's just take a guess of how many people that is in America. You yourself cannot vote because you have a felony conviction for revealing the Bush torture program.
Yeah, and in fact, in Virginia is one of only a small handful of states that permanently disenfranchises convicted felons. I had to petition the governor of Virginia to restore my right to vote, which I did about 6 months ago. And just last week, I regained my right to vote. But it's hard and it's time consuming. And most former felons don't do it.
But Daniel, let me just give you and the audience some numbers. 10% of Florida adults cannot vote. 10%. And you know, remember 2000 election, that was Florida was the big thing. So many black people had been kicked off the rolls for one reason or another. But the police in Florida, the cops, have intentionally overstacked charges, felony charges against black people, knowing that this would reduce the number of black voters in the state of Florida. I mean, people know that. Go ahead, Daniel.
It's a total scandal. I mean, this is the real scandal. This is the real voter suppression that's going on. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans are playing a very dangerous game. You know, I always try to be scrupulously nonpartisan, but I could have kind of can't stand either of the two major parties, but this is the case where the Democrats are on the side of the angels, and the Republicans aren't. But you know, but then again, let's get back to the U.S. Senate, which is in some ways even more egregious.
Let's look at some other numbers. I'm just looking at them.
Yeah.
Because we have the Voting Rights Act was designed, John and Daniel, to protect the right of black voters, and of course we know it was. People risked their lives or were killed. They were lynched if they tried to vote. Mm-hmm. And there were every obstacle put in the way of black voters in the South. In Florida, as I said, 10.4% of the population can't vote because of felonies. That's disproportionately black. 9.6% in Mississippi. 7.6% in Alabama. 9.1% in Kentucky. These are people who can't vote because the cops charge them with felonies.
And those numbers could... and likely would definitively swing elections, presidential elections, senatorial elections. The whole political landscape would be different if convicted felons could vote like they can in places like Ohio, for example. The day you get out of prison in Ohio, you're eligible to register to vote again. In New Hampshire and Vermont, even if you've been convicted of a felony, you can vote by absentee ballot from prison.
Yeah. And other countries, by the way, they actually have polling booths in prisons so that prisoners can vote.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah. And I mean, why should somebody who goes to prison, first of all, you're in prison because you committed a crime. You're not deprived of your citizenship.
That's right.
And also, if you've already done your time and you're out, I mean, the lingering penalty so that you can't participate in democracy, I mean, so-called, I mean, it's just...
inexcusable.
Daniel's right. That really is an outrage. And then there's so many other ways that voter fraud takes place. Can there be, will there be a commission on voter suppression? Is there a commission on voter suppression that can be created? Maybe grassroots activists should create an independent voter suppression commission. Maybe they've already done it. Go ahead, Daniel.
They could. It might happen. There's been a lot of journalists have written a lot about this. So the issue is out there. But, you know, I'm afraid, you know, that my great fear is that a tipping point has been reached between gerrymandering and techniques like this, where essentially the Republicans have gained an edge, which is kind of unbeatable. I mean, they may have fixed things for a long time to come.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, given the fact in 2016, a number we've used before, John, even though the Republicans have this crushing majority in the House of Representatives, in aggregate, the number of people who voted for Democrats in the 2016 congressional elections was 5 million more people voted for Democrats than Republicans. But the Republicans, because of gerrymandering in the various states, they completely have a lock on the U.S. Congress right now, or yeah, it appears so.
And the Senate as well.
Yes, that's right. And the Senate as well. That's, again, anti-democratic and un-American. And we just, for the most part, we Americans just take it.
Daniel Lazar, can it be or will it be that Trump's voter fraud commission could backfire? In other words, by introducing the issue of voter fraud, that the Democrats or independents or Greens or socialists or independents or people who believe in democracy at a basic level could try to turn this around and make the case, just as you are, that really the problem is voter suppression?
Can they? They could. Should they? They most definitely should. Will they be able to do it? That, I think, is increasingly unclear. I think the Democrats are self-destructing. I think Russiagate is turning to a disaster, which will wind up doing the Democrats much more harm than it will the GOP. And so, therefore, the Democrats, I think are weakening. And so I think that I'm not very optimistic about efforts along these lines. I think the Republicans have not only robbed the bank, but I think it looks like they're getting away with it.
Yeah, I agree with Daniel, actually, because the Democrats and the Democratic Party leadership has decided to focus on Russia as if Russia, not the Electoral College and not voter suppression, is the reason that Donald Trump is the president, not the Electoral College. I mean, it's just such
I agree.
And people don't actually, I don't think most people care about that. Anyway, we've been joined from New York City by Daniel Lazar. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear us every day in the Washington, D.C. area between 4 and 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at Sputnik News. You can also subscribe. It's an iTunes podcast. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear. Thank you.